So again, welcome everyone to our monthly briefing for the Patient-Centered Primary Care Collaborative. This is an open forum, a chance for you to ask questions, for you to share information about what's going on in your organization relevant to the topic today. And as many of you will have already known, our highlight for this month has been population health in the patient-centered medical home. So we're really excited that we have today with us Dr. Jan Sidorov, and I'm going to introduce him in just a moment. But I want to encourage you to go to see our newsletter. If you're not currently getting our communications, our newsletters, you can sign up for those on our website. As I mentioned before, this is an open forum, but it really does help if you all keep your lines muted so we can hear the presentation. And then when you're ready to ask a question at the end, please do take your line off of mute, and we'll respond to them as a kind of first-come, first-serve type of order. The call will last about an hour long. We will also post a recording of this call up on our website and make that available to you and your colleagues who weren't able to participate during the live version today. So again, if you can go ahead and mute your lines now, and that will minimize the background noise, and then we'll have opportunity for questions later. I'm hearing a few people that still don't have their lines on mute. Do we have Dr. Sidorov with us now?
Hello.
Hi, Jan. I just got a couple more announcements, and I'm going to turn it over to you. So in keeping with our population health topic for the whole month, we're really going to have an exciting conversation with Dr. Sidorov today, and then we're going to really go out with a bang because next week we're going to be releasing our latest guide from the PCPCC about population health. So the title of that document is Managing Populations, Maximizing Technology. So watch for your email communication about how to get access to that on our website. You'll be able to download it. Incredible amount of great information in there. I want to thank everyone who served as a reviewer for that guide, an amazing group of experts, including Dr. Sidorov. So I will encourage you to pay attention and watch your email for when that is released next week. I'm also going to give all of you a special code for those of you who have not already registered for our conference. As you know, we'll have our big annual PCPCC meeting in Bethesda this year, October 13th through the 15th. So everyone, get your pen ready, your pencil ready. I'm going to give you a special discount code for those of you participating on the call today. If you go and register today, you can use this code, 9WEB2013. That's the number 9, W-E-B 2013. That'll get you $100 off of the registration for the conference. 3-day conference this year. It's jam-packed with all kinds of great information, and certainly we'll be talking more about population health, medical home, and the medical neighborhood at that conference. So I don't want to take up any more time. I want to give Dr. Sidorov plenty of opportunity to talk about population health. Again, he is one of the foremost experts in our country on population health and the medical home. Dr. Sidorov is a general internist with over 20 years' experience in primary care, disease management, and, of course, population health. He's a healthcare consultant and author of the widely read Disease Management Care Blog. So that being said, Dr. Sidorov, I'm going to turn it over to you now.
Thank you. Maybe I should change the name of my blog to the Population Health Management Blog. As everyone knows...
Hello, this is Steve Walters.
Hi, Steve. This is Jan Sidorov. I'm just getting going, and welcome.
Hello.
Hello. If you go to the first slide, I mean, there's the title slide, and I'll have my contact information on the last slide, but the next slide presents an outline of what it is that I'd like to talk about. I'm going to discuss some definitions of population health management, but I'll give you what I think is a handy example to get everyone's thinking cap on straight. And then I'm going to discuss what I believe, just based on my own review of the literature, as well as what I've run into in my consulting career, as many of the key parts of population health management, and they are registries, health risk assessments, risk stratification or predictive modeling, the process of patient enrollment, and I'm going to segue a little bit into the various roles of different types of communication in enrolling patients. Then we'll talk about case management, and then we'll talk about care versus case management, and then I'll get into published data. And I'm the only person not on mute, and that's my phone ringing in the background, and I apologize for that. So if you go to the next slide, just what is population health management? There are two definitions out there that most experts, most peer-reviewed published literature, most PowerPoints seem to refer to, and that is the ARC definition, and the other is the Vendor definition. The ARC definition is there before you. It's an approach to care that uses information on a group, a defined population of patients, within a primary care practices or group of practices, and you want to improve the care and clinical outcomes of that population, of those patients assigned to your practice, or those patients within a network of practices. So, you know, for an accountable care organization, for example, you could see the implications there. There's also the Vendor definition, which many persons on this phone call may not be as aware of. If you go to the Care Continuum Alliance website, and the Care Continuum Alliance is the trade association for the population health, aka these management services to definition, talks about, it's a big long page, but I've distilled it. Added proactive, accountable, patient-centric population, enable informed and activated patients, the integrated delivery of services by care professionals who coordinate with the patient, care and families, emphasizes primary care physician leadership and coordination ranging from well management. Are a health insurer and
sir,
what's going on?
Hello.
Sounds like your phone is up a little bit.
I actually does not mute.
Can everybody hear me? Okay.
I can hear you.
I have you in and out a little bit.
No, you're coming in and out.
How's this?
Yeah, we're trying to mute participants that are on the line. Yeah.
I took my headphone set off, so this
that's
be
much
better.
That's right, much good. Better. Thanks so much.
Okay, I was reading from the slides anyway, but now, here's the way to think of it. If you're an insurer or if you're an accountable care organization, you probably have folks, for example, that keep you up at night that have this chronic condition called diabetes. If you're doing population health management well, as part of the patient-centered medical home, you already know what the mean A1C is in your group of patients. And if you have a medical home or if you have a diabetes program and you don't know what the mean A1C is. You know?
Oh, Dr. Sidorov, did we lose you again? Are you there? Uh-oh. I think
hello?
Oh, there you are. Sorry about that. We got you back now.
I kept getting this message that I was being muted. Oh no,
muted the wrong line.
Yeah,
you're good to go now.
Okay, so if you're a medical home or an ACO and you've got a population of persons with diabetes that you're responsible for, and you don't know the A1C, and you don't have a program specifically designed to address what the average A1C is to try to get it to whatever you've decided your target is, 7.5% or 7%, then the minute you start thinking about those kinds of terms, you're already engaged in population health management. Think of it that way. So if you go to the next slide with population health management in the neighborhood, this is the flow. And if you don't pay attention to any other slides, this is probably the most important one. This is many of the elements of practicing population health. You want to establish a registry, a database that has your population's information in it that you can search and organize and use for ongoing tallies of how you're doing. Once you have a registry, there are mathematical techniques that can help you perform risk stratification, which is important because you want to array your patients by risk from high to low. There are some patients in any population that are more vulnerable than others, and those are the patients that need to move to the front of the line, to the top of the queue. And I'll be talking about the inputs into risk stratification in a little bit. Once you recognize which patients are at greatest risk and which patients are lowest risk, then it's a matter of enrolling them and engaging them in self-care, and that's where care management and case management comes along. And I've outlined some of the methodologies for that that range from old-fashioned telephone calls and mail to email, social media, and face-to-face visits. And then it's up to your care and case managers to provide, to direct traffic cop patients into the right kinds of tailored interventions that are specific to their level of risk. And it can both be outside the organization, as in the neighborhood, as well as inside the organization or within the neighborhood. For patients at low risk, it may be a matter of making sure that they're hooked into preventive services, wellness and health promotion, managing their health risks. For patients with chronic conditions who have a certain burden of disease, it may be a matter of care coordination, telemonitoring portals, disease and case management, and specialty referrals. I'm sure all of this makes sense to patients, to everyone that's listening on the line, but this is basically the flow of the elements that make up commercial population health management, and which is already being conducted in many of the medical neighborhoods anyway. But this is an outline of what's out there. I believe that there is a role for incentives and rewards. We can talk about that at another time if I'm invited back. But it does make sense to, I think, recognize both the work that providers have to do to get patients into the right kinds of programs, as well as maybe patients themselves. But that's a topic for another day. Now, let's look at each one of these boxes in a little bit of detail. The next slide, registries, and I define that as a medical home or neighborhood's searchable data warehouse. Think of it as a flat file, an array of all the discrete data variables that you're interested in on a per-patient basis. And the inputs include, naturally, the electronic health record. I think folks on this phone call will recognize that some EHRs are better at that than others, but that's one of the promises of the electronic health record, and we are getting there. But it also includes, in my estimation, administrative as well as insurance claims data, and this is one of those areas that calls for a partnership between the clinical side of the delivery system as well as the insurance side of the delivery system. And there are some examples out there of true partnerships between insurers as well as the clinicians in combining insurance claims data, you know, all those patients out there with a diabetes claim linked to ICD-9 code 250.XX to better identify all those patients with diabetes that may not have been specifically identified yet in the electronic health record. And the opposite is also true. There's also health surveys. As many of us are aware, in January of 2014, there's going to be a large bolus of previously unknown patients that have never come into the system who have no prior records in paper or the electronic health system and have no insurance claims because they haven't been insured. And health surveys, especially for new enrollees, asking them about, you know, their concerns as well as any past history that they may be aware of. There are validated health surveys out there that ask questions like, have you ever been told by a provider that you have diabetes, yes or no? That kind of information can be put in. And as well as public databases. And I'll give you an example of that. It turns out that I saw some very, very interesting research presented at a meeting one time that looked at ownership of automobiles. And it turns out that the persons that like to own minivans fall into one of two categories. The first are soccer moms, but the second are persons with a higher risk of obesity, because persons who are overweight like having minivans to climb in and out of. You know, the higher elevated captain's chairs allow them to get in and out of the motor vehicle more easily. It turns out that it's an independent risk factor for the presence of obesity, says this research. So using that, using zip code, using partnering with food stores and the like, both public as well as semi-public, quasi-public databases can, I think, are one of the brand new frontiers for using registries to provide inputs to identify patients. A little bit of Big Brother, but I think there are ways around this. As I described, it's very much an evolving science. If you're looking for absolute proof that it works, there isn't, but that doesn't mean that there isn't something to that. This is one of those areas where economies of scale count. I don't know of an individual clinic with an individual electronic health record can do predictive modeling on their registry, but it is something out there. And as I described, it very much enables big data kind of research. And if you want to read more about it, there's a handy reference there. If you go to the next slide, I talk about the health risk assessment. There are public domain health risk assessments out there. If you go to ARC, you can find the University of Michigan Research Center. But I define it as any survey that objectively identifies the chances of a particular outcome. What's the likelihood that this patient's going to end up in a hospital based on what they're writing in their survey? From selective causes, diabetes, heart disease, within a defined period of time, within the next year. HRAs can not only help you as the clinician or you as the insurer to identify persons at increased risk within the next year, but it also can be used to notify an individual as well as the provider of a specific risk. So, hey, Jan Sidorov, you filled out this HRA, and based on this, we've identified you as someone with special needs, and we would like to have you make an appointment to be seen in our clinic, quickly, sometime within the next 2 weeks. Here's a 1-800 number for you to call, that kind of thing. It can also be used to provide summary statistics for program planning. It turns out that while you may believe that diabetes or asthma is the number one condition that you need to be paying attention to, HRAs can point out inconvenient truths that point out things like it's back pain that's the most important thing that your patients are worried about, and maybe you should be providing programs for that. There are problems with HRAs. They really don't fit well into current primary care workflows. When physicians are presented with HRA data, it's difficult for them to incorporate that information into the day-to-day clinical care that they have. And the reason I know that is because I have done HRAs. I provided feedback to physicians about that, and they've yelled at me about it because it really doesn't work all that well. And as a primary care physician, I understand where they're coming from, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a solution in there somewhere. So that's the HRA. Once you have the HRA in your database and you also have your electronic health record or your claims databases, next comes risk stratification. And I touched on that briefly a little bit, but it's not causal. What you're really looking for are associations. We know that diabetes is associated with an increased risk of kidney failure down the line. We know that the presence of hypertension makes persons more likely to end up in an emergency room or a hospital down the line. Those kinds of statistical associations can spot vulnerability, and you can array that vulnerability from high to low based on what I believe should be two key things. The first is actionability. We know, for example, that patients with a claim for lung cancer in their insurance claims databases or patients who have seen an oncologist in the past are more likely to end up in the hospital compared to other individuals. But depending on the cancer and depending on the diagnosis code, that doesn't necessarily mean that you can keep those patients out of the hospital. The trick is, and this is where there's more art than science, you want to identify patients who have actionable conditions or actionable care gaps that make them more vulnerable to be in the hospital that you can do something about, where care management or an earlier appointment with a primary care provider or a referral to a particular program can help them. I also believe that most HRAs and most assessments of how well you're going to be able to take action on a care gap or a particular patient care need is their willingness to change. And within surveys and during the ongoing course of care, both primary care physicians as well as care managers can assess willingness to change. How willing are you, Jan Sidorov, to participate in a program that help you better control your blood pressure. As you can imagine, that is also arrayed from high to low. And by knowing those two things, you can quickly distill, if it's done right, a population of patients in whom you can intervene on who are welcome to who would welcome the chance to do that. Vulnerability is defined by several things, but I really define it as what's the likelihood that this patient's going to get into trouble in the future? What's the likelihood that they're going to be hospitalized? What's the likelihood that they could die? What's the likelihood that they're going to have a high claims expense profile in the future, that this is a patient with $50,000 or more in insurance claims down the road? Oftentimes, avoidable claims equals hospitalization, equals multiple emergency room visits. It's just different looks at the same thing. And as everyone knows, we as providers are being increasingly held accountable both for the quality of care as well as the cost of care. And it's our job to reconcile all those domains of care. Other predictions, it's possible to predict out there based on both insurance claims, using predictive modeling and risk stratification, who has undiagnosed diabetes, for example, who has other chronic conditions. And as I mentioned before, this really does do a good job, I think, of detecting all those invisible patients who haven't bumped into the healthcare system yet. Hello, this is Jan Sidorov. Welcome to the call. Once again, if you go to the risk stratification slide and look at the bottom, I talk about the workflow issue. You know, it's typically not used by physicians for their patients in ongoing care. And there's all, and I've bumped into this, and this is probably something that people should be aware of. You know, there's the whole notion of equitability. If everyone with diabetes has diabetes and everyone should be seeing their doctor, what makes one particular person with diabetes can we really justify moving some patients with diabetes to the front of the line? I found that in primary care settings that can be difficult to convince doctors about. But it makes sense. I try to describe this in greater detail in looking at blood pressure control in the next slide. The purpose of this is to merely point out that some persons with high blood pressure have really high blood pressure, and then there are other persons who don't have high blood pressure. And you would think that persons with really high blood pressure are at greater risk. It turns out that turns out to be true, and the risk is logarithmically increased. So if you've got a patient with hypertension with a blood pressure of 180 or 190 systolic, the likelihood that they're going to have a cardiovascular endpoint is very much higher compared to a person with a blood pressure of 140 or 145. And arraying risk from high to low like this is one way to look at the world. As a matter of fact, I would argue that many of us doctors look at it anyway. If you go to the next slide, patient enrollment, if you're going to be reaching out to patients, keep in mind that you not only have to be clinically appropriate, but you have to be culturally appropriate. Now, I'm a white guy, and I rely on my colleagues, my team members, to help me steer carefully through this. But it's really something to pay close attention to. You also have to pay close attention to the use of multiple channels. It's no longer just a matter of telephone calls and mail. There are other ways of reaching out to patients that involve social media that all of us are aware of. And you also have to keep in mind that there's the opt-in versus the opt-out options that you need to present to patients. We know, Mrs. Smith, that you have high blood pressure. We're assuming that you want to be in the program. Here's your appointment. On the other hand, if you want us to never contact you again, once again getting to willingness to change, you can check this box and we will never contact you again. It's something to think about when you're doing patient enrollment. Incentives, as I described, are an option. It's not unusual to provide incentives to both physicians as well as patients to do this. I point to the wellness literature about that. Keep in mind that recruitment rates typically run 5 to 15%. So if you're doing everything right to reaching out to patients with diabetes or hypertension to get them into your chronic care programs, don't be surprised if you're only going to hit about 15% thanks to limited patients' incentives and lack of physician buy-in, time and compensation of work effort. One of the biggest things that has gotten in the way in the vendor community, by the way, is call blocking, where persons can see on the telephone who's calling, which is very interesting. But that doesn't mean that there aren't ways around that. As I, if you go to the next slide, as I mentioned, you know, the old world is print materials, one-on-one, face-to-face, telephonic instruction. Well, now we've got new education approaches that leverage behavior change, psychological principles of recruitment, assessment of barriers, formulation of strategies to overcome those barriers, goal setting, coaching, support, and follow-up. You can use texting. There's some very interesting literature out there. Facebook has been used to engage patients in their in their own care. A recent publication, as I recall, in the Annals of Internal Medicine, found Facebook had a salutary impact on patients at risk for HIV disease. Shared decision-making and patient-centered care are all part of this, which brings me to case management. I have a feeling that some of the individuals on this phone call are nurses, and I would like to announce, and I've announced this before, that your ship has come in. You bring so much value to the healthcare system. It hasn't been well recognized in terms of your special relationship and the special approach that you bring to patient care. But when nurses are involved in case and care management, and I'll talk about the difference in a little bit, it can make all the difference in both getting patients into these programs, directing them to where they need to go, and then providing the kind of follow-up that they need. I provide here a Case Management Society of America definition of what case management is all about. It's in small type because they take this very seriously, and they provide a lot of detail about it. But if you read it, you know, how could anybody argue with this? I think the point is that within population health management, the role for providing and supporting all the mechanisms I described above, leveraging, you know, the assessment of vulnerability and getting patients into the right program, typically falls to the nurse case managers. They're the ones that include the HRA in their care planning. They know that they may not understand the predictive modeling, but they know that some patients are higher risk than others, and they can prioritize patients' needs. They can facilitate patient enrollment, pursue engagement, and coordinate all the programs, referrals, and social factors that mitigate risk and get, you know, improve health and get patients to where they need to go. Now, parenthetically, I'll point out that I'm using nurses both as a believer in nurses, but I will point out that there are other settings that rely on other types of non-physician professionals. Pharmacists, for example, know a whole lot about helping patients navigate the pitfalls of medication management. There are persons who are credentialed in patient education. Respiratory therapists, dieticians are all perfectly capable of doing this kind of thing. But I think in most settings, most situations, the typical model has involved registered nurses who perform these roles. And you know, in my travels, I've seen them make a big impact. I think there's a if you go to the next slide, there is something of a difference between case and care management, you know, and I provided definitions of both, and rather than read them to you, case management is more one-on-one, hands-on advocacy, planning, and care for persons with significant healthcare needs, high-touch, high-intensity individual. Care management is defined more as a package of physician-supervised interventions. It's more population health management-ish, if you want to think about it. More medium intensity relies on higher tech. The a typical case manager, for example, may have anywhere between, you know, a caseload of 50 persons up to 200. You know, I think once you get beyond that, it starts getting a little silly, and 200 a little bit much. But it's usually between 100 to 200 persons. Care management, it's not unusual for a person charged with care management to be leveraging social media, mass communication techniques, the clinic, you know, with periodic face-to-face visits as well as telephone calls, to have, you know, an active portfolio of patients. 200, 300, 400, it's higher. But there's significant overlap, which is why those two circles intertwine. And I can tell you that depending on what setting you are and where you are in the country, different people have different approaches, different systems have different amounts of overlap here. And it's really a transition, which is what I try to describe in the next slide. For those of you without a background in health insurance, if you look at costs, charges per member on the x-axis, and you look at the number of enrollees on the y-axis, this is typically how the slide portrays. Over on the left, there are a number of enrollees who never see the doctor and have zero charges. Most of us see the doctor once or twice. We have low costs, but there's a lot of us. And then as you go off to the right, there are some patients who are catastrophically ill and have very, very high charges. For those persons on the left who are low risk and low cost, population health management would provide for those services for those individuals. Lower your risk, wellness, preventive services. For those persons way on the right who are high risk or high cost, you're talking about case managers who provide high intensity, one-on-one, lots of hands-on care for persons who have, for example, stage 4 heart failure. And then in the middle, medium risk, these are patients who could go, in my mind, either way. They could either go low cost in the coming year or high cost in the coming year. You want to figure out who those folks are, array their risk from high to low, and then provide either care or case management to those individuals. They fall in the middle. And note that I put that the boundary between those two lines is quite flexible, depending on your resources as well as the approach that you want to take. There is no right or wrong answer here. Now, why is care and case management an emerging collaborative an emerging opportunity for collaborative teaming? It's becoming increasingly apparent to everybody that teams make all the world of a difference in healthcare. Physician leadership is something that many organizations recognize, but as a physician leader, I can tell you that in many instances, it's my job to get out of the way and trust my team, trust my care and case manager to do the right thing in a team-based view of shared accountability. There are studies that are increasing, that are demonstrating credible cost savings. There's a favorite that I have that I haven't seen quoted very often that appeared in Chest years and years ago that showed significant savings. I believe that in a time of constrained access to primary care, having patients not only be able to access their primary care provider, but to access other members of the healthcare team who can point them in the right direction makes a whole lot of sense. So it offers patients another pathway to primary care. And, there is growing interest among regulators, policymakers, and politicians in using care and case management to help point patients in the right direction and use every kind of technology at our disposal to make that happen, including telemonitoring programs, which I define as, calling patients, using social media, using monitoring, physiologic monitoring devices, which are typically tethered to human beings, calling other human beings to ask how they're doing. This is certainly an area where the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. I would point out in the next slide, if you look at the picture of the woman standing by her car, which is taken from Australia, but I still think that the picture speaks 1,000 words. We're talking about care management and case management. These are health professionals who have these characteristics. They're typically mobile. They're not necessarily tethered to a primary care site. They can get in a car and go to the patient's home if that's what it takes, community care settings, for example. There is literature that says that it's important that they interact with patients who you are trying to bend the curve on in terms of risk more than once a month. Once a month seems to be at the very minimum. They have to operate at top of license, usually in partnership with a physician, but in those areas where they can operate under protocol to help direct patients to a more intense medication regime to control their hypertension, for example, makes sense. They have to be connected. You have to have good internet, electronic health record connectivity to allow these individuals to document it is what they're doing as well as to access records. These are full-time dedicated individuals. When I say that, what I'm saying is that if you think that a discharge manager in a hospital can do this part-time in addition to getting patients out of the hospital on time under a DRG system, you've got another thing coming. These are individuals that need to wake up in the morning and go to bed at night thinking about their portfolio of outpatients. There are credentialing programs out there. It's usually a mix of telephonic and face-to-face. They don't have to do it all the time face-to-face. Telephone works perfectly well. They enable patients to do self-care. And last but not least, when you drop these kinds of individuals into a very, very busy primary care setting, I can personally testify. I have seen the ability of these individuals to change care and to have a really favorable impact on physicians, assuming that they also have a willingness to change. I mean, I've seen physicians be resistant to this, but for those practices, these nurses, these healthcare professionals can make a big difference. I wanted to point out that there are some studies that talk about, in case you're skeptical about the use of the telephone, you know, in a commercial setting, for example, to change patient behaviors and direct them to situations of lower risk. This is a table in the next slide by Dr. Wenberg, David Wenberg and all, that was published in the New England Journal. I give you a reference down at the bottom of the slide. That table one shows exactly what was done, and table two shows that, you know, depending on the cost domain, you know, per patient per, I believe it's per patient per month costs, depending on the sector, both from inpatient down to outpatient office, that there were statistically significant savings. And as you would expect, if your change agents were doing things like telling patients to engage in better self-care, you'd expect pharmacy costs to go up, which is exactly what happened. The next slide, I just wanted to point out that according to the latest literature I saw from the American Medical Association just released, the majority of care in many areas of the country is still provided by smallish, less than 11, physician-owned, not ACO, not hospital-owned, physician-owned practices. Some areas have more physician-owned practices than others. I think the AMA report also said that in 2012, 20% of physicians are still in individual solo practice, which is remarkable. It may be closer to 12%, but physician solo practice has not gone away yet. It's definitely getting smaller. So think about that group of providers out there in a geographic network, many of whom are transitioning to medical homes. These are practices where population health management, I believe, becomes more important. These are the practices that you want to provide support to in terms of here's the health risk assessment you can use or will use it. We'll be happy. We, an organization, a support organization, will be happy to provide you with a health risk assessment, public domain. We can help with risk stratification. We can help with the registry. We can help with patient enrollment. We'll put a nurse in your office. Well, you can share this nurse with other primary care networks. And generally what I found is that the primary care settings that benefit the most or the patients in, you know, which patients in which primary care settings are going to benefit the most, you know, we're talking about primary care practices that are community-based, high-performing, willing to participate. I mean, all the things that make them want to be part of the neighborhood. And the reason why I think this works is because there's a report, government report, on the CMS website that talks about precisely this approach being used in their setting, Massachusetts General Hospital. Now, Massachusetts General, many of the primary care sites belong to Massachusetts General, but the individual primary care sites are responsible for their – they are accountable within the system for their own, as I understand it, for their own success. So they have an individual stake. Each primary care site has a stake in doing this. The Massachusetts General system provided them with this level of support. So final slide, you know, what the outline is. I hope I explained what population health management is and all the individual elements that make them up, and I shared some published data. And now with 20 minutes left of the hour, I'll be happy to answer any questions that folks may have. In addition, please note that there's my email and there's the name of my blog. If you Google it, you'll find it. And if anyone wants a copy of the PowerPoint that I just went through instead of a PDF, just email me. I'll be happy to provide it to you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sidorov. I'm going to ask everyone to keep their lines on mute just a little bit longer. We've got a lot of people on the line today, which we're really excited about, but it's going to be a little bit challenging for us to try to answer questions. So I'm going to ask everyone to please keep your line on mute until Dr. Sidorov has responded to the last question, and then jump in. And as Dr. Sidorov mentioned, he was kind enough to provide you his email address so he can accept email questions after the call if you didn't get an opportunity to get your question answered or asked. So I'm going to go ahead and ask for individual questions. Again, if you could just jump on the line quickly, introduce yourself, ask the question, and everyone else will help us out by keeping their line on mute while we're hearing the response.
Hi, this is Wendy Nickel. I'm calling from the American College of Physicians. And
Hi, Wendy.
Hello. Thank you for the very informative material. This is so helpful as we're in the process of launching a new Center for Patient Partnership in Healthcare and really thinking about strategies related to patient engagement. One of the questions I had was around family members, and I didn't hear you talk about family members and their role within both care and case management and being part of the strategy as you try to address these chronic conditions and chronic needs in a population health environment. I was just wondering if you could comment a little bit on that.
Oh gosh, you know, maybe I should. You are right. That's less of a question, more of a good point. That you know, Jan, you ought to put that resource in as a consideration in your PowerPoint slide. Now, in all fairness, when you go to the enter case management slide, you know, I will note that case managers do provide education, informed decision-making, care plan that coordinates insurance, benefit design, psychosocial issues, and input of family. And by that, I'll also include other stakeholder caregivers. So I really look to my partners, my care managers, my case managers, to make sure that family are engaged. But, you know, you make a good point. There is no underestimating the role of family in, as well as community in getting patients to where they need to be. So thank you for that feedback.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Marty Minetti from Care Partners Plus. If I could just add on to that. It's interesting. We have a solution that we're working with on a study that I'm actually a part of also. But it is kind of an in-office kiosk where a patient gives feedback at end of visit, and then it's mobile following the patient at home. So what's interesting about this is, let's say the patient's a diabetic and they've got a blood sugar of 300. When that happens, that risk alert not only goes to the provider or the care coordinator, it goes to a primary family member. And so what's neat about that is now the family is actively involved in understanding what mom or dad or sister or brother is doing. We think it's, you know, we're not far enough along yet in the study, but we think it's going to have a significant impact.
Oh, gosh, you know, I couldn't agree more. Now, as a doctor, I'm a little bit, I will tell you that I'm personally, just from the way I practiced medicine when I was involved in active patient care, a little leery about having the alert go to the doc. I think it needs to go to the appropriate member of the healthcare team, and I would argue that in some situations it makes more sense for that alert to go to a care manager. But with that as an aside, imagine, I couldn't agree more with you, imagine you as a mom of a person with type 1 insulin-dependent diabetes,
mm-hmm.
And you've got a child who's an adolescent. And as we all know, the brains of adolescents are wired a little bit differently. There are monitoring devices, finger stick devices out there, and this is where the technology has already arrived, where if little Johnny or adolescent Johnny doesn't do a finger stick and hasn't checked their blood sugar, the alert goes to a mom and alerts mom or dad or the primary caregiver that something's awry with a follow-up phone call. So I couldn't agree more. You are absolutely correct. And I don't, you know, it's such a no-brainer from a technology standpoint that, you know, I'm surprised it hasn't become, you know, the standard way of doing business when it comes to diabetes management.
Hi, Dr. Sidorov.
Yes.
Hi there. This is Dana Bright from the American Academy of Pediatrics. And I wanted to just make more of a couple comments versus questions. And the first comment is...
Okay.
Oh, we might have accidentally muted Dana as we were trying to get rid of the other background noise. Dana, are you still with us?
I'm on a conference call.
Well, while Dana's getting back on the line, or we're getting her back on the line, maybe we'll take another question real quick.
Hi, yes. My name is Debbie Antoon, and I'd like to ask a question.
Hello.
I'm a pharmacist from the state of Florida, and we're actually working on creating a primary care practice with a pharmacist involved. And as you mentioned, pharmacists, in your presentation briefly, and the fact that you're supportive of teams, and you recognize that, you know, these chronic disease patients all have medications, obviously, where do you see the pharmacist best fitting into this?
You know, there's no right answer. It depends on the setting, and it depends on, some respects, it almost depends on the culture of the organization. I will point out that that Community Care of North Carolina just released, hot off the presses, data showing significant cost savings in their 14 networks that they have. And Community of Care of North Carolina focuses, as everyone on this call probably knows, on Medicaid beneficiaries. And in that population, disabled Medicaid beneficiaries below the age of 65, in that population, medications are far more, shall we say, part of the disabled Medicaid beneficiaries. In that kind of situation, I think, in relation to health care, and with advocate their full setting.
Dr. Sidorov, we're going in and out.
Oh, I apologize. In
still breaking
less
up.
Important. So it's, yeah.
The non. Nope, we can't hear you. Are you there, Dr. Sidorov?
Yes.
Oh, there you are.
Hello.
We got you back.
Well, I was saying that it really depends on the population, and Community Care of North Carolina is a good example where pharmacists can make a really big difference.
Yeah, and just to let everyone know, this is Amy at PCPCC. We do have a link to that article that Dr. Sidorov is talking about in our newsletter this morning. So I would encourage you to go and check out the data and the findings that they're reporting now.
Hi, Amy. This is Dana. Can you hear me?
Oh, we can hear you now, Dana. Sorry about
that. That's okay. So again, I know we're running short on time. This is Dana Bright with the American Academy of Pediatrics. And just a couple comments versus questions. First comment regarding the case and care management. And Dr. Sidorov, I wanted to thank you and acknowledge you for just the mention of how these are specific tasks that need to be taken care of, and that certainly, as you said, while nurses are the foremost people, you know, with providing those tasks, that there are other members of the team and other people from different backgrounds that can certainly carry out those for patients. And I say that, I'm a social worker, and I come from the world of geriatrics and chronic disease management. And again, it's just a little soapbox, but I do think, you know, in medicine, there could be more in terms of an appreciation for what different professions can bring in terms of their perspective and their skills. And so, again, I think it's important, and I, again, thank you for the acknowledgement of really a team-based approach. And the second comment is with regards to some of the work coming out of the different sections of the Affordable Care Act, in the sense of how there are groups looking at really that key transition between an inpatient hospital stay and then that person going back home or going back to a different setting, and the role that population health management, I think, can play in that brief but yet critical transition period. So just a comment with that. Thank you.
Yes, makes a whole lot of sense, and you're reminding me to point out that if this is about cost, one of the low-hanging fruit in reducing costs for healthcare organizations as they increasingly start looking at both upside and downside risk, one of those areas of cost is the 20% rate in Medicare. It's lower in commercial, but the 20% rate in unfettered Medicare of patients ending up back in the hospital within 90 days. If those aren't patients that need to move to the top of the queue in terms of vulnerability, they are. And by the way, there is an HRA out there that can be administered to patients upon discharge that identifies the likelihood of returning to the hospital. Unsurprisingly, many of the things that identify in an HRA as putting patients at increased risk, for example, is the length of the medication list, as well as the diagnosis. But there's some others. So you make a good point.
Thanks so much, Dana. Do we have another question? And just to remind everyone, too, if you're not asking a question, to please keep your line on mute. It really helps minimize the background noise. We've got a couple more minutes to take questions.
Yes, hi, my name is Louise Bride. I'm a healthcare consultant and have a particular focus on patient-centered medical home model of care. Thank you so much for this presentation. My specific question is related to risk stratification and the risk stratification process, and I wonder, are there any tools or resources that you can recommend for small community-based practices that don't have that sort of a tool currently or a process in place?
Yeah, that's a good question. When you look at risk stratification, what you find is that the programs out there are typically commercial. There are no, quote, free, unquote, public domain risk stratification tools out there. But I will say that if you've got a master's degree, and you've got a partner, or you've got a master's degree in mathematics, or you've got a partnership with a local university with statisticians on board, this is really not that much rocket science. It's a matter of typically most regression, most predictive modeling programs use regression, statistical regression techniques to identify independent variables that predict an outcome down the road. So if you've got an outcome such as emergency room visits or claims in excess of $100,000 or hospitalization, it's not that hard to run that through a standard regression model to find out which characteristics predict the future likelihood of an outcome with individual weights, and then you can use that. That's something that the commercial vendors don't like to hear, but for back of an envelope, if you don't have the dollars to spend on a commercial vendor, that's really the cheapest, easiest way to do it. It's really not that hard. It's hard for me. I don't have a background in statistics, but when I talk to my folks with backgrounds in statistics, they don't seem to act like this is a big deal.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Any other questions for Dr. Sidorov?
This is Susan Rogers, and I'm a nurse case manager, and I have my own company, and I'm working with consulting with physician practices. And do you have, like, one snippet of thought that from peer to peer, doctor to doctor, how can I what can I say that's going to convince them of care management, case management effectiveness in their practice?
You know, that is the holy grail of population health management. You know, what is that one sentence that I can use to convince my teenager to do the right thing? You know, with all due respect to my physician colleagues, I mean, it almost comes down that way.
Yeah.
You know, what I found is that physicians seem to fall into three camps. The first camp is this is a no-brainer for them. It's about a third of doctors, one-third to one-half of physicians. You talk to them about, you know, having a nurse come in and, you know, an extra set of hands to help them take care of the patients. They want to know when they can start. The next group, smaller group, are skeptical. They don't like the idea of, you know, intrusions into the doctor-patient relationship, but they're willing to give it a try. And if you've got the right kind of nurse, the right kind of change agent, within a few weeks to a few months, they get it. And then there's a proportion of physicians who are implacably opposed for both good reasons as well as bad reasons. And I have not found that phrase, that incentive, that PowerPoint presentation, or anything that helps change their minds. And within any physician network, within any provider network, those physicians exist, and it's a matter of going around them and working with the physicians that are willing to partner with you. And I just don't know any other way of doing it.
Thank you very much. I agree. It is the holy grail. So if you think that, let me know. I'm kind of like thinking of them as patients that are not engaged or empowered in their own care.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Thank you.
I think we have time for one more question before we wrap up the call today.
I can throw one out. My name's Mark Craig. I'm with a company called Bond Health Watch, and I just had a question as to, this is another, you know, million-dollar question with maybe not a, you know, a solid answer, but who owns the patient? Is it, I see a lot of hospitals deferring to primary care who defer to the VNAs, and I think it comes down, because this is, you know, time and resources that they're going to throw at this challenge. Where do you see, you know, the baton being held in the, you know, to try to do most of the population health initiatives?
You know, that's
care?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I'm going to give an answer that some folks on this phone call may not like. I believe ownership should be tied to risk. So, if who's ever financially accountable, who's ever getting the money, and I mean that in a risk-based environment. So, in a typical setting, before the Affordable Care Act, it was the health insurers that ultimately owned the patients, and that's why they took NCQA and HEDIS and the money that they were getting so seriously. And for whatever reason, both good and bad, the perception has been in the public that they haven't been good stewards of that ownership. They're getting better. And I think that's one of the reasons why they are wisely figuring out how to partner with providers and accountable care organizations. But as you begin to transfer risk down to the providers, down to accountable care organizations, and you begin to participate in these new forms of capitation, and call it what you like, but when you're paying $3 per patient per month to take care of a patient, you are now participating in a limited extent in insurance risk. If there's money left over, you win. If there's no money left over, you lose, depending on the amount of resources that you have to apply. And that insurance risk confers ownership. And depending on, you know, within an organization, if an ACO is taking that risk and transferring it down to the primary care providers, they are responsible. If it's at the ACO level, you know, if they're taking a global cap, you know, of $5 million to take care of, you know, everybody within the 2-county radius of their catchment area, they're responsible. If it's a clinical carve out, just emergency room use, for example, which is part of a lot of ACO contracts, you know, they own that part. You know, it's very confusing, very fractured. You look at one contract, you know, you've seen one contract, but I tie responsibility, I tie ownership to where the risk lies. And we're increasingly seeing insurers as well as Medicare take that risk and transfer it down to the provider. So it is a brave new world for us.
Good answer. Thank you.
That was an excellent answer and a great way to wrap up this call. Again, thank you so much, Dr. Sidorov. You know you will absolutely be invited back. You're already a member of the PCPCC Five Timers Club. So
you betcha.
We appreciate all the expertise that you lend us. And again, for those of you who didn't have an opportunity to get their questions answered, you do have Dr. Sidorov's email address. I also mentioned that we will have this recorded up and available on our website in a few days. Again, one more last pitch for the conference. If you want to register for our conference today, use the code 9WEB2013, 9WEB2013. And we look forward to seeing all of you at the conference in just a few weeks. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thanks.